Last week we started a new topic that I'm quite sure we will finish today, which is learning Bayesian networks and causal discovery. I'll run very quickly to remind you what we were talking about. Two approaches, constraint-based learning and Bayesian learning, Bayesian search. Both of them actually are searches. It's a term in computer science. We perform search for something in a search tree. Early days of artificial intelligence conceptualized everything as a search, every type of human activity, mental activity was search. Let's see. Bayesian networks or causal graphs, remember I quickly reminded them, we played with them in the context of causal graphs. Bayesian networks are just a mathematical formalism that is suitable for representing causality. They're not identical, but Bayesian networks are allowing us to represent causality. So that's why we talk about them. Inference, Bayesian networks are representations of joint probability distribution, and you can perform inference calculations in them. Typical calculation is asking the relevance of observations. So you make a few observations, and then you calculate the probability distribution over other variables. Very useful formalism for many type of things that we do in artificial intelligence. They're really at the border of artificial intelligence, statistics, I guess these two. Because they can represent causality, they're really very close to to science with capital S. I gave you some examples. And then we talked about learning, Bayesian networks. The idea is that given a set of observations, measurements, every record in the table is a set of simultaneous measurements. A typical situation when you observe the world, for example, when I look at the world now, I can perform measurements of some things, right? And that's what we typically do in science. And it is possible to learn the structure. The structure is a representation of independences in the variable. That's the way that Bayesian networks are conceptualized. But it turns out that if you use them to represent causality, many of the independences are going to be very intuitive, very natural, because Bayesian networks are sharing some things with causal graphs. We can also learn the parameters, of course, also from the data set, and have a model that we can use for inference. Causality is fundamental. We've talked about causality for the whole semester. This was just a brief review of the relationship between causality and probability. If you remember, we talked about this in our, I think, second meeting this semester. So when you have causal relations, they imply also dependencies. Causal relations imply probabilistic dependencies. I ran through this example, a different example than the one that we used in the beginning of the semester. And then I essentially reminded you the consequences of the structure. In terms of three rules, the first rule was that when there is a chain of connections and there is a dependence, common causes, common ancestors make things dependent also. And that is captured by an assumption known as causal Markov condition. Assumption, axiom, because they actually approach it mathematically. With axioms, you can prove theorems that give you guarantees. A theory in mathematics is as good in practice, as applicable in practice, as practical are the assumptions. If the assumptions are close to the world, if they are true in the world, then the theory is going to be very useful. So then we talked about causal Markov condition. It's an axiom, not very controversial, and the three rules that we talked about are consequences of Markov condition. And the chains, common ancestors, and observed common descendants make things also dependent. This is the summary of the three. Conditional independence is when you observe something, then you break the connections, break the chains, or break the connection if you observe a common cause, common ancestors, to make things independent. Conditioning can make things dependent, though. If you condition on flat tire, it makes the causes of flat tire dependent. Sidestep, we talked about manipulation, intervention, and that the reason for that was that I was able to show you what experimentation is about. Again, we talked about it earlier in the semester. It's an intervention. An intervention makes other causes irrelevant. And then in the course of the experiment, if you observe that these two are dependent, then you know that the connection must be from smoking to lung cancer, because the other way would be taken out by the manipulation. Of course, we cannot experiment here, and then people talk about causation, causality, and correlation, it turns out that the statement that correlation does not mean causation, which you remember from learning statistics, it's true, but it's not the whole truth. So it's not telling everything. Of course, if you have two variables and just one correlation, anything is possible of the four things. Four actually simplifications, because there may be complicated things. There may be things in the middle, in between, here and here and here. But fundamentally, there are just these four possibilities. But if you have a collection of independences, then sometimes you can establish causation. Of all the possible graphs with three variables, this is the only one that fulfills these four conditions. So a collection of correlations, collection of dependencies, can actually mean tell you what the direction of causation is. Two assumptions in this first approach that we spent the whole meeting on. Markov condition, we talked about this already, and then faithfulness condition is going the other way around. So we talked about what the graph implies in terms of independences. That's Markov condition. Faithfulness is the implication the other way. What can you infer from independences? And the assumption, the condition says, if there is an independence in the data, then it should be reflected in the graph. And that is not always true. When you have multiple paths, it may happen that they cancel out each other perfectly, making the two variables here independent. So the assumption would say, if you observe independence in the data, they are not connected. And that's obviously not true. They are connected. They're connected through two different paths. So we know that this assumption is sometimes is violated. It doesn't hold in the world. They try to prove that under common type of distributions, such a situation when paths are canceling each other out perfectly is very improbable, very unlikely. But it is possible. This slide was demonstrating the idea that certain graphs are not possible to distinguish from one another just based on statistical tests. They are identical from the point of view of statistics. For example, these two, it's the typical case of correlation versus causation. Two variables are correlated. We don't know which way the connection goes, and the other groups. That's not very useful, also a sidestep. And then we talked about the algorithms. There are several algorithms there. It's just a whole class of approaches. The principles are simple. You start with data. You look for independences using statistical tests. And then the second phase is logic, essentially trying to infer what these independences are telling us. What is the possible structure? Two useful theorems which are used in the algorithm. This is the second phase of the algorithm. When we have the independences, that's the input of the algorithm, and the output is a graph, a class of graphs. This is the algorithm, one of the algorithms is the PC, the simplest maybe. You start with an undirected graph, remove edges that between variables that are independent, and then find V structures and clean up. I showed it by means of an example. If this is the graph that generated the data, we will observe two independences. Remember, every missing arc is an independence, really. So there are two independences. We started with a complete graph. We removed arcs for the independences. And then, in the second step, we try to orient the arcs by finding the V structures, which are combinations of three variables. If the preconditions are fulfilled, then you can orient the arcs. That's that special case, if you remember, collection of correlations. And then cleaning up in the last phase, we have to orient it this way because the preconditions of the theorem are not fulfilled, so this is not a V structure. V for the letter V, two causes coming into an effect. So we orient it the other way, and then the last arc, we avoid the cycle. It's not always possible to orient all the arcs. Sometimes you have just a graph. For example, let me get Genie here. Let me see if I have that. I don't think I have that. Oh, maybe I can. Or maybe it's remembered here, the data sets. If you have a data set generated by a graph like this, this graph belongs to a class of indistinguishability that contains three graphs. X causes Y, Y causes Z, or Z causes Y, Y causes X, or Y is a common cause of the two. The same independences, the same things that you observe in the data. If you generate a data set out of this, let me get a data set out of this, and you try learning, essentially you will learn a class of graphs. That's a class of graphs denoting the three cases that I just mentioned. So not always possible to retrieve a graph, but sometimes it's possible. I talked about patterns. These are the additional arcs, the red arcs or the double-edged arcs. They are used to represent a class of graphs. I mentioned to you when playing with data that it's a good practice when you use these methods with data to vary the alpha level. And I wanted to say again, to remind that you don't know, but there is a chance that you will want to use these methods to look at your data. Every one of you probably collects data in the context of experiments. You may want to look at the data to see what the data are representing. So that's why I think it's not only interesting from the theoretical perspective that it's another way of conducting experiments, but it's also a useful tool that I think many of you may actually start using. I have at least a couple of cases when students, your older colleagues, were actually using this. I met with them, gave them some advice, and so on. So it's actually a very useful tool that is non-experimental, but still useful in figuring out what is happening. You need to vary alpha level, because if you remember from statistics, if you have for any given fixed alpha level, if you perform many tests, you run a risk of rejecting the hypothesis wrongly. So it's a good idea to make it very small. It's also a good idea with a small data set to make it large to see a whole range of graphs that this leads to. And the different ways of doing this allow you to see which arcs are robust, which should be there, and which independences are also robust. As you change the alpha level, those that stay are essentially robust. You can trust them. I showed you that in an example. You can play with it later. And here is where I ended with the slides. We played with the software. So what I will do now is I will finish the slides first by showing you the second approach to learning, which is equivalent in theory. They have actually proven that under ideal circumstances, when you have a nice big data set, the two approaches should give you the same results. That's the theory. There's a nice saying, you know, in theory there's no difference between theory and practice, but in practice there is. So there are two different approaches, and it's a good idea, I think, to actually try both if you have a data set, to see which things are common, which things are different. So today I will talk about the other approach. I will also show you some methods for evaluation of models that you learn. I have also a slide presentation on that. And we'll play. Whatever time is left, we'll just play with the software. So today we will finish that, this approach. We are meeting once again next week. This is the last meeting. I'm going to talk about another way of experimenting that can be called a simulation, useful for especially for modeling societies, collection of animals, plants, or things that is called artificial societies. It's a good way of doing science, as you will see, that I have no doubt within a few couple of decades maybe will lead to Nobel Prizes in economics, I think. Very exciting way of doing science that is very computer-based. Okay, so let's proceed I played with that already with the software, so you remember when you have a data set that is continuous, you need to check if the distribution is multivariate normal. And there's a theorem in statistics saying that the distribution over several variables is multivariate normal if every marginal is normal and every relationship is linear. So you just have to check pairwise, is the relationship linear? And also the marginals. So the second approach, Bayesian search learning. It is easier to understand. I guess it's much simpler to learn, but it's harder to see the connection between this approach and causality. That's why I spent much more time on the first approach. In this approach, it's also search-based. Why is that first approach search-based? Because you are also searching for a class of graphs that represents the data. That's why the first one, called sometimes constraint-based search, it's also called a search. This one, you will see that it's so clear that it's a search. In this approach, we have a representation of the current structure, like this. I'm searching for a graph among three variables. Then I need to have an initial structure. Where do I have it from? I generate it randomly. So the first step in the algorithm is to generate an initial structure. People usually do it randomly. So just generate the structure. And then you need a scoring function. I have a slide on the scoring function. Scoring function essentially is a way of comparing the structure to the data. It's telling you how well the structure fits the data. Why do you need that? You need it because the algorithm transforms that initial structure in a variety of ways. There are three operators. You can add an arc, and then you obtain another structure. You can delete an arc. You can delete this, or you can delete the other arc. Every time you apply an operator, you get a different structure. So now when you have an evaluation function, you can say that this structure is better than this one or worse than this one. It allows you to compare those structures, evaluate them. So we need a scoring function. Different algorithms in this class use essentially different scoring functions and different search heuristics. Heuristics are rules of thumb. Computer scientists here know what they are. They are rules of thumb, essentially, telling you what to do roughly. Why do you need heuristics? Because the search space, when you perform the search for the graph, is essentially intractable. The size of this search space is 3 to the power of the number of combinations of 2 out of n, where n is the number of variables. So if you have 3 variables, how many pairs do you have? 3. 3 to the power of 3 is 9. 9 different structures, nine different graphs to compare. But if you have 10 variables, how many do you have? How many structures do you have? Well, it's 3 to the power of the number of different pairs among 10 variables. Number of combinations of 2 out of 10 is 9 times 5, 45. So it's 3 to the power of 45. And that's a huge number already, a huge number. If you have one more variable, that number explodes, yes? With 20, you have 3 to the power of 10 times 19, I think. So it's 3 to the power of 190. That's a huge number. I think it's more than the atoms in the universe. So you're dealing with a huge space of graphs. We are traversing that space by transforming the graph. And then from the new graph, we are, again, trying different graphs. And that forms a tree in which we are trying to identify the structure that is the best. That's the procedure. So this is search. You need heuristic because there is no way you can look at all the graphs. So heuristics are usually very simple. Greedy search is a concept in computer science telling us that in searching for something, we go always in the most promising direction. The next step is the most promising. A very simple application of this greedy search is when you were doing numerical solution of solutions of equations. Maybe you are doing it in high school or university. Actually, I have it on one of the next pictures, so you will see that. That is also a greedy search. We are going in the direction of the highest ascent of the function or highest descent of the function, most promising direction in the multidimensional space. So in computer science, a procedure like this is called greedy search because you want the reward right away. You want it. You want to go in the most promising direction. And that's really it. That's the whole algorithm. The rest are just details. In particular, the search heuristic. Here is what one of the simplest one. What we want to do is we want to find the structure with the highest probability given the data. So we want to maximize this expression. We want to have a structure that has the highest probability given the data set that we have. By Bayes' theorem, we can reverse it, saying probability of data given the structure, if you remember Bayes' theorem, times probability of the structures, and then divided by the probability of the data. If you are maximizing, that's your task, then you realize that this is a constant, probability of the data. It's a constant, essentially. So we can take it out. It's a normalizing constant, so no longer will this be between 0 and 1. But if we are looking for the maximum, it doesn't matter what the range is. We just say it's proportional to this without the probability of data. We are still maximizing this expression. You have in theory the possibility of putting prior probabilities over different structures. But in practice, I've never seen anybody doing that, given especially that there are so many structures. So if you use a uniform prior over your structures, just you don't care about the prior, then the only thing you need is probability of the data given the structure. And that's a very easy thing to calculate in a graph that you are learning in the Bayesian network. It's just a product of individual probabilities, because a Bayesian network is a representation of the joint probability distribution, so that's actually an easy calculation. If you have n variables, you just need to perform n multiplications, and you get this. So the search heuristic is actually, evaluation function is actually very easy to calculate. And that's really it. If you remember in the constraint-based search, the trick was that we had an alpha level. An alpha level, you should really change it going both ways. One day we'll probably make it kind of more automatic in the software. You know, you press the button, go to have coffee, and the software will actually go through the entire range of alpha levels and draw some conclusions. So we had to change the alpha levels in that approach. Now, in this approach, because we are dealing with a search heuristic, you are essentially, and you are looking in for a needle in a haystack. That's an English saying. Well, actually Polish too. Looking for a needle in a haystack. Igła w stogu siana. The space is enormous. So what do you do in such cases? Well, think about it. Think about finding the maximum of this function using numerical methods that you had probably in your mathematics class, in your calculus class. What do you do? Well, you start randomly somewhere and then calculate the value of the function. It's a function that we cannot solve analytically. Yes, we have to solve it numerically, the maximum. You find, you start with any point and you look at the value of the function in this point. And then if you're looking for maximum, then you are applying a procedure that is known as a gradient descent. You're going in the direction of the highest gradient, which is, in this case, if you are here, you are going that way, which is going to the right a little, checking again and again until you reach a point where going further to the right or going to the left reduces the value of the function. And then you have a maximum. Now, what's the problem with such a procedure? If you have multiple maxima in a function, then you may hit a local maximum. If you start, for example, here, then you will probably find this maximum. You will not go any further with this simple heuristic, the greedy heuristic going into the direction of the highest rise or descent of the function. So if you start here, you are still going to the right because you see that the function increases in this direction. You find this point and then you stop because going further or going back will give you lower values. But you will find the local maximum. If your task is to find the global maximum of this function, then the answer is restarts. You try with different values, repeat the procedure. When you start here or here, you'll find this maximum. And you start it with different places many times. And the maximum that was the highest that you found is, there's a good chance that you found a global maximum. No guarantee, of course, but there's a chance that you found a global maximum. The same thing happens in these algorithms. If you remember, let me go back to that slide. We start with a random structure and then try to modify it in different directions. So that's equivalent to starting in this picture from some position randomly and then trying to find the maximum around there. These algorithms perform restarts in order to find a structure with the highest score. That's what they are doing. So the trick here in this algorithm is the restarts. I'll show you that in the parameters in the software. So you try many things, and for a while, of course. How many do you try? As much as you can afford, time-wise, of course. Yes. Because, maybe you get some. Well, you can do it in a smarter way, probably. Find the intervals where you have that you have already examined, and then do it smarter. But if there are many maxima, big function from minus infinity to infinity, you just keep starting in different places. There are certain. These are just comparison between the two classes of algorithms. Maybe it's. Let me see if there's. It would be boring to go through each of them. So, I just wanted to say the important things. The constraint search base, which is the first one, is quite efficient. There is less of that idea of a needle in a haystack. Why? Well, because every independence that you find in the data reduces the search space tremendously if you find an independence. Of course, the risk is that independence can be wrong. Yes, you're doing a statistical test, so maybe the test has given you an error, wrong result. Yes, but otherwise, it's a nice thing. Frankly, when I have a new data set that I analyze, and I've done it many times with people, researchers or clients that I had worked with the software, when I have a new data set, I usually start with the PC algorithm, the constraint search base. Why? I trust it more for some reason. You know, the independences, when I try the different values of alpha, I can reasonably identify independences and also trust them. So my search space is smaller right away. It's an older technology because it was originally developed in the late 1980s, early 1990s, which is old for this work. It's, I would say, almost 30 years now, so it's already old. The problem is that you are depending on independence tests. And in statistics, not every possibility is covered by that. For example, there are no good independence tests for mixtures of continuous and discrete variables. So if you are dealing with a data set with mixtures of continuous and discrete, unfortunately, there are no independence tests. So this approach will not work too well. There are good, very efficient independence tests for discrete case. And if you have multivariate normal distribution, then there's also a very good test for that. But not for the general case. So people have tried different things, not enough, I think, trying to use some Bayesian independence tests, playing with the data, trying to come up with something that will work in all cases. This is an active area of research, so things are changing. In Bayesian learning, it can reasonably deal with missing values. The first approach, this one, doesn't work too well with missing values, unfortunately. Again, because the independence tests don't like it. But in the Bayesian case, in principle, it's not difficult to deal with that. You can specify prior knowledge in terms of the probability distribution over different structures. But as I told you, there are so many structures that it will be a challenge to specify prior distribution. How do you do that over a gazillion records structures? Many open research questions. It's essentially intractable. The search space is too big, so you need search heuristics. And they will lead to local maxima, which you should counter by restarts, by probing different starting structures. I told you about this already, the retention problem. If you remember, we spent quite a lot of time on that, maybe 10 minutes or so. The interesting thing in that data set was that everything was correlated with everything. So you see, when you have a data set and you see everything is dependent on everything, what do you do? Well, it turns out that some of the dependencies are indirect. If you remember, if you have a chain of connections, then things are dependent on that chain. But when you condition in the middle, then you realize, oh, they become independent. So these dependencies that you see, pairwise, everything is dependent. Some of them are dependencies that are induced by connections, by common causes, by chains. So I don't mean to say here that the whole approach comes from me. There are several people working. In fact, the people who developed the constraint search base are philosophers working at Carnegie Mellon. Glimmer, Spirit, as Shyness. Another person who did also a lot of work was Yuda Pearl. And there is probably worldwide, probably a few tens of people working on these methodologies. I was just one of them. It's not, and I did do some studies that had practical implications. So some of the things we tried is how is the algorithm robust to departures from normality assumption. It turns out that it's quite robust. If the data are not too far, not too weird, you can actually still use the assumption of multivariate normality. I've done some work with combining the two techniques. The idea was to use the constraint search base to look for independences and get good starting points for the Bayesian search algorithm. That was another idea we had. Also, learning graphs in time-dependent domains, so learning dynamic graphs. That is still in the area of research. I don't think there are any practical, usable algorithms at the moment. Graphs and causal manipulation. So a lot of things. We played already a lot. So let me finish this slide and. Then we will play a little bit with the Bayesian search algorithms. I'll show you them in the software. And then maybe I will come back to the idea of evaluation. So what do you do to evaluate the models? And then if we have any time left, we will just play with other data sets. I'll pick a data set from the repository in Irvine and just show you how I would go about analyzing that set. So the first important thing is, and that's a reason why these methodologies are also part of this course, is that observation is a valid scientific method. Remember, establishing causality, which is what the main goal is, it depends on our assumptions very often. Even if you conduct an experiment and you have dependence, independence between the independent and dependent variable in the experiment, you also need assumptions there. You need to assume that the correlation is not accidental, for example, right? That's an assumption. You need to, when there is no dependence, you need to assume that there were not multiple paths, for example. You have to make those assumptions too. They have a way of dealing with this kind of, you know, a little bit sneaky in statistics by saying you have a null hypothesis and when the data are sufficiently weird, you reject it. But when they are not weird, then you say they were not enough to reject the hypothesis. That's essentially avoiding the problem of the faithfulness assumption. They don't, you know, they are independent. You say, well, they were not enough to reject the hypothesis. But essentially, when you think about common sense, when you see they are independent at the end of the experiment, so smoking and cancer are independent after the experiment, what do you say? Probably smoking doesn't cause lung cancer, right? But that's not a sound inference without assuming faithfulness. So in every case, you can make causal inferences using assumptions. For example, if I observe that I observe correlation, and if I assume that there are no common causes, and I assume time precedence, then I can probably infer there's causation in the direction of the causation. Yes. Smoking and lung cancer, I observe correlation. I assume there are no common causes. And I assume that first you smoke, then you get cancer, right? Time precedence. Well, you can assume, you can probably infer that smoking causes cancer. Of course, it's two strong assumptions. You shouldn't be doing that. These methods assume Markov condition and faithfulness. That's it. And they are actually quite powerful. I told you that in the case of the retention data set, our findings were confirmed by an experiment, which was very, very nice. Observation allows us to restrict the class of possible causal structures, whether you use these methods or not. Observation actually tells you a lot already. It's quite exciting, this line of research in computer science, statistics, philosophy. These are the three disciplines that come together here. It's a powerful way of doing science, I think. It's less powerful than experiments, but remember that experiments are more expensive. It takes time, effort, money to conduct an experiment. Analyzing data is much, much cheaper. So if you ask yourself what is the best something, it depends. Yes, it depends on the price, the strength, etc. What is the best tool? A shovel or an excavating machine? It depends. A shovel is very inexpensive. You can do it yourself. If the hole is small, it's actually good enough, yes? If you want to make a big hole, then an excavating machine would be probably better than a shovel, because a shovel will take you a month to dig. It always depends. These methods are not as powerful as experimentation, but quite powerful, and you don't need to experiment. You can just analyze data, which is, I think, wonderful. Many unsolved problems, there are still people working on it, presenting in conferences, in writing journal papers. So a lot of things are happening still. The fundamental contributions have been made, but there are a lot of other things to do. Gini, which we used in this course also, nice thing that you can get it for free in academia and you can just use it. So let me show you the Bayesian search algorithm. I'm starting with the same data set that I just used just a moment ago. This is the data set that is generated by this graph. If you remember, you cannot distinguish among different graphs that are in this class. So if I do Bayesian search, if I do a PC algorithm, I just did it, but let me repeat it again, I'm getting a class of graphs. And that's what I also like about PC. If I do the same with the Bayesian search algorithm, it's the first one on the list, Bayesian search. I'll come back to the parameters in a moment. If I do that, please note that it finds me a graph. But this is a misleading thing, because this is the way Bayesian search works. It finds you a graph, always a directed graph, because you start from a directed graph, you look at the data, you can modify the graph, but you always end with a directed graph. So there is this graph, actually, you cannot trust the direction here, but what you can do is you can look at the pattern. There's a special function here in the software. This graph is indistinguishable from among three different graphs. And that's what you can see. For any Bayesian network that you have, let me get any Bayesian network from the repository. Let me get, for example, this Bayesian network. It's a Bayesian network modeling alarms in an intensive care unit, I think. So for this graph, there's also a class of indistinguishability. Actually, not that huge, that class, but this connection and this connection are, if you generate data from this model, you will not be able to retrieve those connections. So for every graph, you can display the class of indistinguishability, in particular the graphs that you learn. We just learned this graph using Bayesian search. You can look at the class of indistinguishability by showing pattern. A PC and the constraint search base will give you that class from the very beginning. It never goes later, further than the class, which is I like it. Let's see. Let's try a few things with it. Let me try, for example, another data set. The example from slides. Here it is. If you remember, we were able to learn that network using the PC algorithm that was on the slides. Here we are, A, B, C, and D. Yes? Let's try Bayesian search here. A, B, C, and D. It is missing one arc. But it's remarkable that you get graphs that are very, very similar to the between the two algorithms, even though they are based on completely different principles. And when you have a data set that you want to analyze, a good idea is to actually try different algorithms and see what you are getting out of that. Now, given that we have the algorithm, Gini produces always a text box on the screen that summarizes the algorithm, the parameters, etc. So let's look at the parameters of the model, of the algorithm, the Bayesian search algorithm. This is something that was also there in the PC algorithm, the maximal connectivity. It limits the number of parents to only 8. If you reduce it, it will make the graph simpler. Here is the important parameter, the number of iterations, the number of restarts. I can make it 20,000, for example. 20,000 times am I going to generate an initial structure and then continue from there. Actually, that's too many because there are only 4 variables, so there are probably not that many structures to start with. But let me do it. It's quite fast anyway, with 2,000 restarts. Did I get a better graph? I don't think so. I got much worse graph. How do I know which graph is better? When you generate a graph, in the text box that you get the score. Score is essentially, here it is, it appeared in iteration 782, and this is the score. The other run, let's see where the score is on the bottom somewhere, minus 23,188. This one is a better score. Why is it a negative number? If you remember, in that formula that I showed you in the score, we calculate the probability of the data given the structure. Probability of the data assumes that every record is independent, and probability of a single record is usually a small number. A concrete combination of variables, it's a small number, a fraction, between 0 and 1, but closer to 0 than to 1. And then every record is independently generated, that's an assumption. You multiply that. So you multiply a small number by other small numbers, how many times, depending on how big the data set is, 10,000 records, many, many times. So you get a very, very, very small number. Instead of operating with that small number, what people usually do is show the logarithm of that number. So this is the exponent of that number. Because it's a very small number, very small fraction, the exponent is negative. So the lower the absolute value, the better the score. So this one is better than that, but not much better, right? So we didn't do any amazing things with that. Let me try an experiment I loaded this alarm network. Let me get it again. Let's generate a data set from that network. Let's do... maybe not so many. Let's make 2,000 records. That will account for good variability in structures. Fewer records, more errors in independence tests. Let's make it, this data set. It tries to write in the temporary directory, I think. Let's go to the desktop. Open it in Genie, and try learning. So if I now learn a new network using Bayesian search, 20 iterations, the standard, here's what I'm going to get. Here is my model. You see, it's quite sparse. There are many arcs missing, which is very nice. Let's look at the score with 20 iterations. Here is the score, minus 22,000. In this case, it should make a difference when we make many more restarts. Let's make the number of iterations. I don't want to go overboard, really, because we may have to wait for too long. Let's make it 10 times as many, 200. At some point, it goes faster because it cuts the search when the score is clearly going to be higher than the best so far. We should get a better score now and also a better structure. So this is one way of comparing. A structure that gives you higher score is generally a better structure, although that's not completely true because the actual... score is also penalized by the complexity. If you don't do penalty for complexity, then the highest score will be that of a complete graph. If you have a complete graph. But that's, of course, a silly idea to have a complete graph. You want a graph that is reflecting the independences and the things in the... Let's see the scores. Is it better?
It's exactly
the same. Disappointing, isn't it? Maybe if you run it 20,000 times. What I will do is I will run it in the background when we talk about evaluation. We'll see if it ever comes with a better score. Let me just show you a couple of other algorithms here. The PC algorithm is the only one that belongs to the class of constraint search base. There are two general purpose Bayesian search algorithms. Bayesian search, the basic one, and another one, greedy thick thinning. It's an algorithm that is using a different heuristic. The way it works is it tries to add arcs to improve the score, so it restricts the operations in the search process, and then it starts removing the arcs until no longer improvement is possible. Different principle, very fast algorithm, but also no restarts because it's just one run. So it's a very fast algorithm and produces actually quite good results in my experience. Let's see if what is the score. I think the score is better, isn't it? Minus 18,000 compared to minus 24,000. So this graph should actually be better than that one. What are the algorithms? There are two other algorithms that have nothing to do with looking for causations. So out of just to satisfy your curiosity, I will tell about them, but these are not really causal discovery algorithms. Naive Bayes is an algorithm that constructs a structure that is by assumption fixed. This will not make sense, but I'm picking one of the variables to be the class, and the structure is by assumption such that the variable chosen is the parent of everything else. By assumption, very, very strong assumption. It's used mainly in computer science, in machine learning for classification, naive Bayes. Those of you who have had classification probably have heard the term naive Bayes. The other two algorithms, again, I'm going to spend just a minute on them because they don't belong to this course. They don't do the causal discovery. A little bit they do, actually. A tree-augmented naive Bayes assumes that there is a naive Bayes structure, but does learning of additional arcs. As you see, it puts additional arcs between these variables. So it does learning of dependencies, but it's really far from giving them causal interpretation. Their last algorithm is very similar, just puts no restriction on the number of parents. The tree-augmented naive Bayes makes the number of parents not more than two. Augmented naive Bayes allows you to put more parents to a child, to a node. Oops, it's going to take time. I'm going to cancel it because we don't need it. In any case, the graphs that you learn are useful numerically, but don't give you the insight into the causal structure. So now we have learned several structures using this data set. Now the question is, how do you compare them? One way of comparing them is to look at the score. But the score is, I don't always trust it. Like, look at the example from the slides, if you remember. The graph that was really far off had a slightly better score. And that is caused by heuristic plus penalty for complexity. The penalty is actually violating this idea that the data set fits the structure best. So what are other ways of evaluating? So here is what I the promise second where is it? Here it is, I think. Do I have the validation slides here? I don't. Ah. But I should tell you about the validation. So let me get it from another place. Maybe oops, I'm unprepared. I think I will have those slides in here. Okay, that should do it. Validation in general, it's a useful thing that it has opened. Okay. that may be useful beyond actually the causal graphs that we have been learning. Let's see. Of course, when you have multiple models, you use statistics like we do now, so you know, you can, like in this joke, you can prove it or disprove it. Statistics can tell you with something. So that the fundamental question is, how do you know that the thing that you have discovered is worth anything? So how can you compare? You notice that we got different graphs from different algorithms. How can we compare? Which of the graphs is better? The score was one way of comparing, but actually it's imperfect. People tell different things, just, you know, they run an algorithm and then they say, oh, I'm just reporting what I'm seeing, my model does well in practice, different things. So there are different ways of evaluating something that you do. The last one is probably the most powerful. I told you that that's what happened when Carnegie Mellon conducted an experiment confirming our finding. Generally, when we evaluate things, we use this approach that is called in statistics representative sample. In fact, in doing science, we do that. We have a population, let's say a population of people on Earth, and we select our subjects, we talked about it many times, and conduct experiments on the subjects. Look at the statistics, sample, etc. Look at the properties of the sample. And that's an image of the world. We can make guesses about the population based on that. There are several fundamental ideas. The first one that you should know when you apply any of the machine learning techniques, any data analysis by computer, the first idea that is very important is known as cross-validation. The idea is simple. If you want to test your model, because what we would like to do is we would like to test the models that we learned in comparing the models, somehow test them. But testing the model on the same data that you use for learning, for training, is not fair. It's almost like teaching a course and then during every class working on the exam questions, exactly the questions that are going to be on the exam. A subset of the questions will be on the exam. So the best strategy for the students would be to learn the answers by heart. And then they will write the exam perfectly. But they will not do very well if you give them different questions. They will not have learned the principles. So the same idea is in learning from data, in machine learning. You don't want to test the model on the same data that you used for training. Well, let's skip this. This is the simplest way is known as holdout method. So we have a data set. We divide it into two pieces, two parts. One is the training data set, and the other piece is a test data set. You perform training, learning on the first data set, and then test the models that you learned on the test set. It's simple and quite effective. It fulfills that condition that you don't test on what you have used for learning. What are the disadvantages of this approach? Well, you waste a lot of data that you could use for learning. The whole test set, if you have very few records, like suppose you have 200 records and you want to put aside 100, then you have to learn from 100 records. That's not a very big data set. So wasting the records that you could use for learning is the first disadvantage. And the second thing is that with small data sets, you could be subject to luck or coincidence, because you may be lucky or unlucky and select the test set in such a way that it's going to be tough on the model or easy on the model. Right? It can happen by chance. Probability, of course, is not very high, but it can happen. So these are the two advantages. And to address these two disadvantages, there's a wonderful invention very young, really, I think it's 1980s or 1990s even, known as K-fold cross-validation. If you have a data set, suppose this is the data set, just one column in this table, you divide the data set into equal parts. If it's called K-fold, you divide it into K parts. Suppose it's 10. You divide your data set into 10 parts. You use 9 of those parts as one data set that has 90% of the records for training, and then you test on the 10th part. So if you have 200 records, you divide it into 10 different pieces, you leave aside 20 records, and you have 180 for training. That's much better than having 100 for training. In the second iteration, what you do is you pick a different subset of the 10 for testing and train again on 90% of the data. So you will pick the second one to be the test set. During every iteration, you pick a different one. You do it k times, so 10 times in this example. Each time, you are testing it on a different subset, and each time you have a fairly large data set to train. Effectively, you test your model on all the data, and so you reduce that the chance effect that you are unlucky, and you have a nice big data set. So it's a very nice invention called K-fold cross-validation. An extreme case of K-fold is known as leave one out. When you have n data records, you divide that set of n data records into n parts. So if I have 200 records, for example, I divide it into 200 parts. Every part has just one record. And I leave one record, let's say the first one, aside for the testing. I train my model on 199 records and test it on one record. And do it 200 times. Each time, I test it on a different record. So the same idea, just many more subsets. What is the disadvantage of this leave one out versus tenfold cross-validation? Takes time to calculate. That's the only disadvantage that I can think of, because otherwise the advantages are wonderful. I'm still testing my model on every record, but for training I have a very large data set each time, almost the entire data set. As you will see in practice, if you have moderate data sets, hundreds or thousands of records, leave one out is very fast anyway. You don't need to worry about the timing. But I can imagine that when you have a few hundred thousand records and complicated structure, that testing, leave one out testing, may take time. Other approaches, bootstrap is selecting the test set randomly each time in a loop that you perform n times, yes, that loop. You decide how big the n is. You can repeat it many times. Now, so that's the foundation, the idea of cross-validation and the leave one out and k-fold cross-validation. Now, what measures can we use in comparing models? Some of the measures you probably know very well, but let's just quickly review them. Accuracy is the simplest. You can ask the question, how good am I in predicting the value of a variable that I want to predict? For example, you're using a model that is doing diagnosis of a disease, so you can count how many times, what percentage of times, the model predicted correctly the state, disease or no disease or whatever the disease, yes? Sounds nice, doesn't it? Accuracy, essentially. How accurate am I? Unfortunately, it's very, very sensitive to the prevalence. Suppose you are dealing with a model that wants to discover cancer. The probability of cancer is 1 in 100, because the prevalence is 10 in 1,000. The light is disturbing us now, really. If you just look at accuracy, the best model, and I don't know if it's the best, but a very, very good model that gives us 99% accuracy would be one that guesses no cancer. For every case, no cancer, no cancer, no cancer. Gives you 99% accuracy. Yes? But you are missing all the cancer cases, which is what you would like. So accuracy has this big disadvantage. It's sensitive to the base rate, to the prior probability of the classes, to the asymmetries. So next response that people have come up with many years ago is sensitivity and specificity. You've known these terms. They are essentially looking at accuracy within the class. That's the idea. So sensitivity tells you how often you discover correctly that there is the condition that you are looking for. So you could say, how often, what is the percentage of cancers that my model will discover? That's accuracy within the collection of cancers. Specificity gives you the idea of accuracy within the other group, healthy people. How accurate am I among the healthy people? How often do I say correctly that they have no cancer? And I'm not going to get into the details. I actually took this all from Wikipedia article, which is very good, explaining step for step what they are. If you are interested, you should probably work out a few examples and look at them. You probably know what sensitivity and specificity are. I suspect that in your experiments, in your work, you probably also need to use sensitivity. I would be surprised if you didn't use that in your experiments. The article is good, so no need to actually look at it in very much detail. This is a good table, again, picture from that article, showing you the relationship between different terms. Accuracy, sensitivity, specificity, true positive, false positive, true negative, false negative, positive predictive value, negative predictive value. These are all defined essentially in such a way that they give you insight into accuracy within the class, different classes. Here's an example worked out, a practical, very concrete example, bowel cancer and blood screen test. So essentially this is a screening test. You look if there is any blood in the feces. Simplest test that you should absolutely do at some age. So it shows you how you come up with the sensitivity. And by the way, this is a real test, and you see that sensitivity is actually not terribly high. Specificity is not perfect either. That's a these are typical parameters for screening tests. When we had COVID, COVID test was not perfect. You probably have heard of cases like there was a ski jumper who tested positive. They wanted to eliminate him, but he retook the test, which came out negative. It means that the first was false positive, essentially. Happens a lot. Screening tests are inexpensive, popular, but they don't have very good parameters. This is the example worked out, calculated for those numbers. The next thing that is that you will see in when you deal with machine learning, with computer science machine learning, to which these methods belong to, is the term confusion matrix. Very funny term, but Americans especially they love to use funny terms in English to denote new things. You probably heard the term bug, debugging. Nothing comes to my mind now, but there are many terms like this. The next thing that you should all know what it is, and it's a very important way of evaluating models and tests and things, is known as ROC curves. How many of you know what ROC curves are? Does anybody know what they are? That's all right, but you should know, because you will see that in papers, and it's good to understand it. I will go slower here, because that's a really cool term. Here is a picture that explains that, the idea. By the way, the name is funny. ROC is Receiver Operating Characteristic. The name comes from information theory, which was developed, a mathematical theory of information developed in the 20th century, middle of 20th century. The theory talks about source of information and recipient of information, and information is transmitted through an imperfect channel. So, you send things, packets to the internet from a source, and then you receive it somewhere. Sometimes, occasionally, there are problems. There are some bits get flipped, and there is an error in the transmission. The same we have when I talk to you, for example, and I say something, and you didn't understand what I say, right? That's also an imperfect channel. It happens in communication. So that was the theory. Receiver operating characteristic essentially tells us about how good the recipient of information is in getting the information. So it tells us how good that recipient is, how noisy the channel is, essentially. And let me explain you the idea, how it was applied in other places, for example, in evaluating things. The idea is the following. If you are to evaluate something, for example, we have a test for, let's say, body temperature is a test for COVID, right? If you have a high temperature, you have fever, there's a chance you have COVID. Sometimes in well-developed countries like Singapore, for example, there are cameras in the airports that are screening people passing. If they detect somebody has higher temperature than 36.6, they'll take you aside. It's the first thing that they were doing. Here is on the x-axis is the temperature, body temperature. Here are the people who are sick, have COVID. Here are the people who don't have COVID. People who don't have COVID may have higher temperature naturally. The 36.6 Celsius is just, kind of known to be average, but I bet if we measure our temperatures, they're going to be differing. Every human is a little bit different. So this is a distribution of temperatures among healthy people. Well, healthy, but maybe they have flu, maybe they have other things, right? Maybe there's some infections, something that sometimes raises the temperature. But the temperature will raise or go down during the day. For women, it changes during the monthly cycle by, I think, half degree or 1 degree even. A big, big change. If these are healthy people, and these are sick people having COVID, and you use temperature to detect COVID, please note that you are going to be always making errors, no matter what you do, because these two populations overlap. And this line has been decided that, let's say, 38.0 or higher is fever or is COVID. You decide that. It's a decision that is made. If you have ever worried about, for example, blood pressure, you know that there is a magic number. What is it? 120, right? Where does this number come from? In English, I would say, in a funny way, pulled out of the ass, or out of the nose is maybe not nicer. That number was essentially invented by medical community. Cholesterol. When I was much younger, it was 210, the magic number that tells you have hypercholesterolemia. Today is, I think, 190. Again, pulled out of the nose, essentially. Not completely. There are reasons for actually putting it there and not there, but it's something that was decided by humans. There's no physical reason for that being here. So now, look that you can move that threshold. As you move that threshold to the right, what will happen? Well, you will have fewer false positives, but you will have more false negatives. As you move it to the left, you will have fewer false negatives, but more false positives. So you need, it is decided typically where that threshold is. As you move that, you change the proportion of false positives, false negatives. So you are changing the sensitivity and specificity, essentially. Yes. So let me just jump forward. This is a good slide to stay again for a couple of minutes. So this is the thing that I've been talking about, moving that line. And as we do that, we plot in the following coordinates. This is the probability of false positive, which is 1 minus specificity, because it's essentially probability of true negative, yes? Here we have probability of true positive on the y-axis. Every system, no matter what, if you move this line to the left, to the infinity, you will get zero false positives. Everybody is going to be classified as having COVID, but also everybody is going to be classified falsely of the healthy people as having COVID. So false positives are going to be very bad, and but false negatives are going to be zero. That's false positives are going to be here. We are going to be here in this point. Right? If this is infinity. If we move it to the infinity, plus infinity, we are going to be in this point. Everybody is going to be classified as healthy, so false negative is going to be 100, or true positive is going to be 0, and false positives are going to be 0 too. Every curve, and as you move it, essentially you are plotting the value of false positives and true and false negatives proportions on this thing. This curve is known as ROC curve, receiver operating characteristic. Please note that this tells us everything that we want to know about temperature as an indicator of COVID. It's the nature of the problem. It's there. Yes. We cannot move these distributions. They are there in the world. We can just characterize how good the temperature is in detecting it. And that's the idea. And you can do that for cholesterol, for for anything. You can do it for a model. If you have a model, you can actually draw a ROC curve for a model, telling that curve will tell you how good the model is. What is the perfect curve? The perfect curve is when these two distributions are completely separated. Yes? Then, at some point, when that vertical line is there, it will separate them perfectly, and you will have 100% true positives and zero false positives. Yes? You are going to be here. So a perfect curve, you cannot see that. Lower left, going up to here, and then going to the right. That's a perfect ROC curve. Anything else is imperfect. And worthless ROC curve is diagonal here, essentially worthless. You see that in practice. And these are practical ROC curves, taken from a paper somewhere. Somebody published it. Not very good, but I guess some problems are just very difficult. Some problems are hard. It's their nature, but it tells you the nature of those problems. Another thing that ROC curve allows you to is to pick a combination of sensitivity and specificity in such a way that is optimal in some way for some reasons. I'll show you that in a moment. The next thing that people do is they, as you see, if you want to compare the three, which one is the best? Hard to say. So what they do is they calculate the area under the curve as an indicator of goodness. A perfect ROC curve has the area 1, because it goes like this, to the top and then to the right. Worthless has 0.5. So practical AUC will have some value between 0.5 and 1. That is the idea of AUC, area under the ROC curve. Just one number measuring it. That number is not enough. One of my students here, doctoral students, was building a model for predicting the day of ovulation in woman's monthly cycle. She had many models, and these are ROC curves for different models. You might feel tempted to say, okay, this is the best one, right? Has the biggest area. But it depends on the application. A model predicting the day of the ovulation depends on the application. If you are using that model to become pregnant, I guess that will be fine. But if you want to avoid pregnancy, then it's really very bad when the model tells you it's safe to have intercourse. So it gives you false negative, right? You want to be on this line as soon as possible. You want to be have zero false positives, very safe model. This curve gets there the fastest. Even though it doesn't have the highest AUC, it's still the best curve. That's the idea. So AUC is an approximation. Watch out that it depends on the problem, which curve is the best, which model is the best. Last thing, calibration. We have, I'll just explain the calibration and we'll play with the software a little bit next week in a meeting. The last thing that that is also used for evaluating models is calibration, probabilistic models. What is the idea? When you hear the weather forecast, they tell you there is 80% chance of rain. You would like that 80% to be very precise. Why? Well, because you can use it in making a decision. If they say 20%, you say, well, I'm not taking my umbrella. If it's 60 or 70, considering that you can get wet, the inconvenience of carrying the umbrella, etc., you say, well, with 80%, I'm going to take my umbrella. You want it to be precise. You undergo an operation. Doctor, will I live? Doctor tells you. It turns out that people want to hear numbers. Doctors like to say, oh, you'll live. But you really want to know the number. And you want that number to be precise. You want the doctor to tell you 93% chance that you will live, or 98%, and you want that number to be conforming to the statistics, actually. You want it to be precise. Actually, people really want that. So weather forecasters are actually very well calibrated. They are penalized for wrong predictions. What does it mean, calibration? Whenever they say 80% chance of rain, if you look at all those days when they said that, 80% of those days should be rainy. There should be rain. That's a good calibration. So essentially you compare the prediction in terms of probability to the actual data. And that's the idea of calibration. Perfect calibration curve, you cannot see it. It's a good time to finish the class. Starts with 0, 0 and is diagonal to 1, 1. So when the model on the x-axis tells you the probability, that's the probability produced by the model, the x-axis. These are the frequencies observed in the data. That's the y-axis. Diagonal. Every prediction is perfectly fine. That's a perfectly calibrated model. And this green thing that you see is a practical one taken from some model. Not bad, but has some imperfections. They can be different. This is overconfidence, the green one. Something that is seen in people a lot. People are overconfident. Very often they say, oh, I'm sure. I bet my life on it, right? And then they give a lot of probabilities close to 0 and 1, but in fact, probability 0 that they give, or close to 0, corresponds to the whole range of probabilities in the data, actually. It goes like this. Naive base has this shape. And the perfect is, of course, diagonal. That's it. That's... Sorry, I think I took 2 minutes too long.